From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Musical chairs in Washington as the space shuttle program winds down. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Panetta will replace Gates at the Pentagon, and Petraeus will replace Panetta at the CIA, a major shift of familiar figures in the Obama security team. Can Panetta reduce military spending and cope with 2.5 wars? Will Petraeus bring a military mindset to spying? We'll look for some answers. Tomorrow's launch of the second-to-last American space shuttle is expected to draw up to 1 million people, including the president and recovering Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords, whose husband, Mark Kelly, will command the Endeavor. We'll talk with former astronauts about privatizing the space program and get an update on Giffords' recovery. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warren Alney, back with To the Point. At the Pentagon, the CIA, and the war in Afghanistan, the most important personnel shakeup in the Obama administration. We'll hear about that today and talk with former astronauts about what's next for the government's manned space program after tomorrow's launch of Endeavor. First, this news update. The swarm of tornadoes that hit 6 southern states yesterday killed well over 200 people, at least 160 in Alabama alone. Many more have suffered serious injuries, and property damage is described as catastrophic. Joey Kennedy is editorial writer and editor of the...
You're live. Go.
He's also editorial writer of the Sunday Viewpoint section for the Birmingham News. Joey Kennedy, good to have you on our program.
Thank you very much.
Your governor has pointed out that you can't evacuate when you only have 5 minutes' notice of where a tornado is going to strike. Tell us what it's like to have the experience, as you did, of not knowing whether you're going to be hit or not.
Well, actually, the weather forecasting is pretty good on these things now. And quite frankly, pretty much everyone knew. You could even see it on TV. They were showing these tornadoes live. It's the first time I've ever experienced that, where you actually saw tornadoes live, and the weather commentators were talking about where they were hitting, and they were accurate about where they were hitting. But there's sometimes that your safe place just is not safe enough. And when you have a mile and a half wide tornado going through a community, there's not a whole lot that's going to be able to stand in the way of that. And it's devastating. It is devastating to the community and the people, and it leaves you rattled. I will tell you that.
As it turned out, you were not hit. But what was it like? What did you experience as you anticipated that possibility?
Well, I was at one point standing on my front porch in an area where the tornado was possibly going to come by, and I saw that the rain shield had passed, and I felt a little more comfortable. But then I saw debris falling out of the air, shingles, pieces of wood, paper. Coming out of the air, and all of us along that street in my neighborhood were just pointing and looking at these representations of life that were coming down from the sky. And it is profoundly sad today. Over 160 people were killed in Alabama, many in the area where we live. I have friends and colleagues who have lost their homes, and it's a sad day.
I'm sure that it is, and I think all our listeners feel very sympathetic to all of those who lost so much and lost it so quickly. How long does it take for the tornado to pass over?
It can be calm, and the very next instant, just an explosion. So you know something's happening. These things don't sneak up, but you know that the atmosphere is unstable, and then it gets calm, and then it's just an explosion. And that's what it looks like afterwards, too. And I'm sure you've seen a lot of the pictures. It's just devastating. Nothing can stand in the way of a 250-mile tornado.
The pictures are extraordinary. What about the history of this kind of thing in Alabama, and how does it compare to what's happening now?
Well, Alabama has a long history of devastating tornado events. We live in a tornado alley. This is the worst, though, since 1974, when an outbreak in the South killed more than 300 people. But I wouldn't be surprised if, at the end of the day, there are areas that have not been looked at yet. At the end of the day, that this doesn't, the death toll doesn't go above 200 just in Alabama on this storm.
How do people prepare?
Well, we have very good weather forecasting. There are weather radio warnings. We have sirens, and they generally operate very well unless the power goes out and the siren goes out. And people get into a strong interior room, or they go. We have many, many houses with cellars here, and that's what you do. But if your house is completely annihilated, and many of these are, you can even be blown out of a cellar. And you know, most of the time, the deaths occur from things, objects hitting people, and you can just protect so much against that kind of storm.
You can be blown out of a cellar?
Sure, sure. If the floor of the home comes up, then and there are instances of that happening even during the storm. You get to your safest safe place, and sometimes in these huge F5 tornadoes, that's just not safe enough.
How's the response going, the search and rescue operations now?
They're ongoing, and again, there are many, many people who are volunteering to help do tree cutting. The National Guard, the governor properly called out National Guard to help with search and rescue and cutting up trees and making sure that neighborhoods and communities are accessible. This is such a wide outbreak. It's all over, the central to northern part of Alabama and other states as well. And so there's nobody has the resources all alone just to handle a situation like this. So it takes a lot of people to step up. And I'll tell you, that's one of the great things about our community and our state is people come together, they step up, they help each other, they put, differences aside and get to work.
Joey Kennedy, editorial writer, blogger, editor at the Sunday Viewpoint section at the Birmingham News. I understand President Obama will be there tomorrow. Thanks very much for being on our program. Later on, the launch of the Endeavor as the government's manned space program goes on a hiatus. In a moment, the national security shakeup on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 10,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. Defense Secretary Robert Gates was a holdover from the Bush administration, and when he decided to call it quits, President Obama had a problem. He's decided to solve it by moving CIA Director Leon Panetta to the Pentagon and General David Petraeus to the CIA, and the shakeup goes beyond those top jobs. Tom Ricks was a Pulitzer Prize winner at the Washington Post. He wrote Fiasco, the American Military Adventure in Iraq, and he's now senior fellow at the Center for a New American Security, and he writes the best defense blog at foreignpolicy.com. Good to have you back on our program.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
Mr. Panetta has a long experience in government, in the Congress, in the White House, and, of course, at the CIA. Does it prepare him to be Secretary of Defense?
Well, it depends on what you want him to do. Is he a warfighter? No. Is he ready to manage the Pentagon? No. But they have other people who can do that for him. Frequently, what you'll see is a defense secretary is Mr. Outside. The deputy defense secretary typically will be the person who manages the day-to-day, support functions for the military, financing, acquisition, and so on. I think the signal that President Obama is sending by picking Panetta for the Pentagon is that he is serious about cutting the defense budget. Remember, Panetta's background in Congress was as a budget guy. He was at one point chairman of the budget committee. So I think he's going to try to bring down the budget. And also, Panetta at CIA has shown that he can manage a large and frequently unruly institution. The CIA has a reputation of either undermining or capturing the civilian Senate to run it. And he seems to have escaped those fates. So I think Obama thinks he can do the same sort of thing at the Pentagon, which is keep a lid on the place and not make it a political problem.
Panetta was a budget guy in Congress. He also had the Office of Management and Budget under the Clinton administration before he became the President Clinton's chief of staff.
Yeah, and so he's got time at the executive branch in Washington. Here's a guy who understands the politics of the budget and so on. So I think given what President Obama wants, he's probably going to be a good guy for the job.
On the other hand, if he's Mr. Outside, there must be a lot of insiders who don't want to see the budget cut.
Well, I think the military is in for a very big surprise here. You know, the U.S. military, people do careers of 20 years typically and then go out and retire. So you have a lot of people who are halfway through their careers in the military who have never known anything but very fat times. Because since 9/11, 10 years ago, the military has just had bundles of cash thrown at it. And that environment is ending. And I think it's going to be a rude shock for literally hundreds of thousands of people in the military who kind of have grown almost a sense of entitlement to as much money as they want. It's going to be very different. And I think you're going to see some rough times. I could see us having this conversation a year from now saying, did you ever think Panetta would have such a rough time at the Pentagon? And I'm going to say, well, given the assignment to take down the budget, yeah, but his job is to manage that.
What about the rough time he'll get in Congress, where so many of the members are able to go home to their constituents and say, we have got a subcontractor here in our congressional district as a result of my efforts to get a weapons system, for example, even though the Pentagon itself doesn't want it?
The defense contractors play that well, and you see that most notably when Dick Cheney was defense secretary. He tried to close the V-22 program for the Navy, the Marines' very high-tech helicopter that takes off like a helicopter but flies like an airplane. And he was unable to do it. So, yeah, that's very rough. I think, though, Panetta is likely to have a better relationship with a lot of people in Congress than Cheney, who is not seen as particularly collegial by a lot of members of Congress.
And Panetta is. He's a charming man.
I've never met the guy, actually. He's interesting. He's an outsider to the national security establishment. I covered the military for 20 years. I still see a lot of people in the military establishment. But I've never crossed paths with Panetta in all that time.
For what it's worth, he has been on our program, and he appears to be. He's certainly a nice guy to talk to, in any case. Tom,
how do you think he'll do?
Don't ask me. I'm not the expert on the Pentagon. Let me also talk about General David Petraeus, who became America's favorite military leader after the successful troop surge in Iraq. The president gave him command of the war in Afghanistan. Now he wants him to succeed Panetta as head of the CIA. Paul Pillar was the CIA's National Intelligence Officer for the Near East and South Asia. He's now Director of Graduate Studies at Georgetown University Center for Peace and Security Studies. And Paul Pillar, good to have you on our program.
Hello, Warren. Nice to be with you.
Well, thank you. What about General Petraeus? There have been other generals, other military people in charge of the CIA. What are the problems that you foresee with him, particularly given, presumably, that he'll have to oversee intelligence about the war that he has just been in charge of?
Well, that last thing you mentioned is the one reservation or concern I would have. I don't think we need to worry too much about whether someone comes into that job wearing a uniform or not. As you mentioned, we have had both military and civilians who have come into the job of director of CIA. The most recent one was General Mike Hayden, who was an Air Force general, did a very successful job. But the concern that you mentioned is a legitimate one, and this is not a negative comment on the integrity of General Petraeus, but rather just the difficulty in separating the personal stake one has in how an endeavor that one is so thoroughly identified with and was indeed responsible for, how that will be perceived in the months ahead, separating that from objective analysis about how, in this case, the war in Afghanistan would be going. And so, you know, from the perspective of analysts in the CIA who would have to assess 6 months from now, a year from now, how the situation in Afghanistan is going, and might come up with assessments that perhaps would not reflect favorably on the strategy used there or whatever, I would be concerned about how General Petraeus would respond to that.
His public statements about the war and the way it's going have been at odds with what a lot of other reports have said. Has he been at odds also with the intelligence findings?
Well, we haven't had assessments made public any time recently. There's the odd leak or two about what intelligence analysts are supposedly saying. And I suppose as long as things are kept out of the public eye, this doesn't necessarily need to be a problem. But I think we're talking, Warren, mainly about developments that have yet to unfold in Afghanistan and assessments and analysis that has yet to be performed. So it's just hard to say.
Paul Pillar, formerly with the CIA. Back to Tom Ricks, formerly Pentagon correspondent for the Washington Post. Who's going to replace Petraeus in Afghanistan?
The plan is to nominate John Allen, who is a Marine general, not well known to the public, but an intriguing pick. If you ask me to name one general officer I know who is similar to Petraeus, I would say it's John Allen. If anything, a bit more of an intellectual than Petraeus, despite Petraeus' PhD from Princeton. John Allen, as a brigadier general, which was not very long ago, he was promoted very rapidly, as a brigadier general, was the guy the Marines sent to negotiate with the insurgents across the Middle East, these sheikhs who were running the Al-Anbar insurgency in western Iraq, but were living in Jordan or Syria or the Gulf states. He would go and meet them in hotels and talk to them and cut deals with them. An intriguing guy, he once told me if he hadn't been a Marine, he would have been an archaeologist. He's fascinated by the writings of Gertrude Bell, who was a British archaeologist and writer who spent a lot of time in the Middle East in the first two decades of the 20th century.
So an interesting pick, as you say. Has he ever been in command, or has he had an assignment in Afghanistan?
No, he was in Iraq, and currently he is the deputy commander at Central Command, and I think actually was pretty focused on Iran during that, because somebody had to think about Iran while everybody else was dealing with Iraq and Afghanistan. So he's kind of working his way across the region, first serving in Iraq, then thinking about Iran, now going to Afghanistan.
Paul Pillar, back to you. Isn't it true that there's more intelligence gathered by the military than there is by the CIA? Does that make create an issue when a general takes over the supposedly civilian intelligence agency that might concern people that that are worried about the dominance of the military?
That's an issue that's come up from time to time, and it can be raised again now, especially given that the Director of National Intelligence, James Clapper, is also a military officer coming out of the Air Force. Again, that doesn't really concern me so much. You're quite right that in terms of the overall volume of raw intelligence collected, most of it is by the military, and most of it quite tactical. The underlying concern when this issue comes up is that as important as our ongoing wars and other military missions are, the intelligence community and the CIA have to serve other national security functions. They have to support the president and other policymakers, including in the State Department and elsewhere, by covering other issues, collecting on and analyzing other issues. And so the concern is with too many people having worn uniforms at the higher ranks of the intelligence community, there is going to be an overemphasis on the military mission. Again, I wouldn't be too worried about that, particularly since so much of the national security mission these days, including what the CIA has to follow, is in support of military efforts.
Tom Ricks, back to Leon Panetta at the Pentagon. You said that he'll be Mr. Outside. Somebody else will, pardon me. So we'll actually manage the department itself. But what about the wars? Won't he be responsible for the withdrawal from Iraq, for whatever is going to happen in Afghanistan and also for Libya?
Well, what you're going to see in those wars, and I think this explains all of these moves together, is I think more emphasis on civilianization of the wars as we try to get out of them. So we're supposed to have U.S. forces out of Iraq by the end of this year, unless some sort of new understanding is reached. And we're also supposed to be drawing down in Afghanistan. This is one reason I think that the final of the ships is important, which is naming Ryan Crocker to be the U.S. ambassador in Afghanistan. Crocker has served in Afghanistan before. In fact, he's been ambassador to just about half the countries in the region. But he served in Afghanistan and in Pakistan, worked well with Petraeus and other military people in Iraq when he was ambassador there. So I think what you're going to see is the civilians, namely Crocker, taking the lead in Afghanistan and John Allen kind of standing behind him to run the military aspect of that in drawing down. So I think the message about Panetta is he's going to be doing a drawdown by himself in the Pentagon. That's going to be his main focus, and the ball is going to be tossed to others especially diplomatically, on both Iraq and Afghanistan.
And Brian Crocker will be replacing an ambassador who doesn't get along very well with the president of Afghanistan, Mr. Karzai.
And by the way, is a retired Army general himself, Lieutenant General Carl Eikenberry. Not only didn't get along well with Karzai, had a reputation of not getting along particularly well with Petraeus either. I think it was a little bit naive of the Obama administration to believe that just because they were putting an Army general in as ambassador, that he would get along well with Petraeus. In fact, Petraeus and Eikenberry in Iraq were kind of in two opposing factions about the way forward in Iraq.
Paul Pillar, back to you. What about the reorganization that you mentioned of the intelligence community and the creation of a new agency of which the CIA is a part? Is that going to be a problem for somebody like David Petraeus, who wants to be in charge?
Well, it's an additional challenge. We had this reorganization in response to the public appetite to do something after 9/11, do something big and visible. And of course, here in Washington, one of the big visible things that we normally do when we're not sure what else to do is reorganize. So there was the split up of the old job of Director of Central Intelligence, who in that job was both leading the CIA and leading the whole intelligence community. Now we have two jobs. One is the one that General Petraeus is about to fill, Director of CIA, and the other is Director of National Intelligence. And quite frankly, the confusion that was created by that organization has in many ways continued to persist. The legislation that divided the old job of Director of Central Intelligence simply wasn't detailed enough to make it clear which of the functions of that position devolved to the Director of CIA and which to the Director of National Intelligence. I trust that General Clapper and General Petraeus, being both experienced and reasonable people, will find ways to get along. But we've seen some indications of the kinds of tussles over the last couple of years, most notably the one about who gets to appoint overseas intelligence representatives. Should it be the DNI or the Director of CIA? So this will be an extra challenge for General Petraeus in establishing his new turf, when there is this whole additional bureaucratic layer in the form of the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, which a few years ago did not exist.
Okay, and very briefly, Tom Ricks, we just got seconds left, but there's also going to be a new chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff.
Eventually, it's not clear who it is. With the movement of Petraeus to CIA, the smart money is saying it's going to be either a Navy Admiral, James DeVries, or a Marine General, James Cartwright.
Well, thank you both. Tom Ricks, now blogging at The Best Defense at foreignpolicy.com, author of Fiasco, The American Military Adventure in Iraq, and Paul Pillar, formerly with the CIA, now at Georgetown University. Good to have both of you on our program.
Thank you.
We're going to take a very brief break and come back to talk about tomorrow's launch of the Endeavor, the end of the space shuttle program, and the recovery of Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords. You can join the conversation on our To the Point Facebook page. Back in a moment with the To the Point from PRI.
A complete archive of past programs is available online at kcrw.com/to the point. You can also order a CD copy by calling 1-888-600-5279.
Warman Ali back with To the Point. Tomorrow's launch of Endeavor will be the second to last in America's space shuttle program, which has lasted for 30 years. President Obama will be making his second visit to the Kennedy Space Center, bringing his wife Michelle and his daughters Sasha and Malia. Mark Matthews is Washington correspondent for the Orlando Sentinel. Today he is in Florida. Mark Matthews, good to have you on our program.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Last time the president was there, he outlined a vision for NASA, which is very different from what it has been in the past.
Yes, he did. What President Obama wanted to do the last time he was at the Cape in April was put the agency on the course of relying more on commercial rockets to reach low Earth orbit so NASA engineers could concentrate on building futuristic spacecraft to go beyond. This was a plan that was met with some heavy opposition in Congress, who wanted to see NASA continue to build and operate government-run rockets, and a debate that still continues today.
Still continues, hot and heavy. What about the atmosphere right now at the Kennedy Space Center? I understand people already are beginning to gather and that the crowd may get up to a million.
I'm not sure about the million figure, but Florida highway officials are concerned enough that they've cut off construction on local highways in order to help the flow of traffic. And if finding a hotel right now is just about impossible. I think a lot of people are beginning to realize that this program is coming to an end, so much so that the Kennedy Space Center Visitor Complex actually went to a lottery system to dole out watch tickets fairly recently within the last year because demand was so high.
Wow. No doubt it will be very high for the final launch as well. But let's focus on this one. What is the Endeavour going to do?
The primary mission of the Endeavour is to bring up a science instrument called the Alpha Magnetic Spectrometer. And it's looking into some really far-out stuff. They want to look at basically what it'll measure is to try to figure out the origins and the makeup of the universe. Everything from this type of strange thing called dark matter, which is believed to almost in a way be the backbone of the universe, an unseen, visible backbone of the universe, to antimatter, which some astrophysicists believe had a key role in the creation of the known universe.
Has most of the work done by the shuttle, most of the things that it has carried back and forth, been for science or for the military?
The shuttle primarily has been for civilian uses, particularly since the Challenger crash, the Challenger accident. Mostly what it's been doing over the last decade is construction work, construction of the International Space Station.
And what then happens on the space station?
Right now that the space station has expanded from a full-time crew of about 3 to 6, before when they were at 3, basically what the astronauts were doing were simply making sure that the station stayed afloat. But now that it's gone to a full crew, they're doing a number of microgravity experiments, particularly in the areas of the medical field.
Now, if, in fact, as you indicated, there's not going to be any more a shuttle program and NASA is going to be focused on something else, what's it going to rely on to get people to the space station?
In the near term, we'll be using our Russian partners that the astronauts will be flying aboard the Russian Soyuz spacecraft until NASA's able to come up with a replacement, which, depending on everyone's guess, could be somewhere between 3 years to even as many as 10.
We were talking earlier on our program about Leon Panetta going to the Pentagon with the idea of reducing its expenditure. He's going to get into a lot of problems in the Congress. What about what you mentioned earlier, the opposition in the Congress to the president's plan to fade the shuttle program out?
Well, phasing the shuttle program out, an idea started after Columbia and was pushed by President Bush. The idea was to reduce the overall maintenance and overhead for the space shuttle, which costs, I believe the figure is something about $2.5 billion annually, and which makes sense. I mean, the space shuttle is the most complex piece of machinery ever built by humanity. I mean, it takes a lot of people to make sure that it runs correctly. And the hope is to go to something simpler, something that might be able to, that won't require as many hands in order to reduce that cost. What exactly that would look like is something that we're still trying to figure out as a country.
And how does Congress feel about what's referred to as the privatization of this effort?
There are some folks in Congress who do support it, although I would say the majority of folks, or at least the majority of lawmakers who have a specific interest and have the power to do something about it in the space arena, do favor NASA continuing to have some type of government-run rocket, which again, the debate is whether or not that is the most cost-effective way to have a space program.
Okay, Mark Matthews, again, Washington correspondent for the Orlando Sentinel down in Florida for the launch of Endeavour tomorrow. Ken Bowersox is a former astronaut. He flew 5 missions on the space shuttle, including the shuttle Endeavour. He's now vice president of the Astronaut Safety and Mission Assurance Department at SpaceX. That's the rocket company owned by Tesla Motors founder Elon Musk. Ken Bowersox, thank you very much for joining us today.
Hey, thanks for having me on the program.
First, as a former astronaut, how do you feel about the idea of the government, at least in a temporary way, getting out of the business?
Well, I wouldn't say the government is really getting out of the business. You know, what's going on is a progression that has happened since the beginning of human spaceflight. If you look at the early days, the government would design vehicles, and then commercial companies actually built the vehicles. Through the shuttle program, there was a push to get more and more of the work transitioned from government-badged workers over to contractor-badged workers. And we came very close to transitioning the ownership of the space shuttles and the crews that flew them to contractor personnel rather than government personnel. So this is one step that didn't happen in the space shuttle program that's going to happen with the next phase of commercially developed vehicles. The commercial companies will own their vehicles, and they have the potential to provide private flight crews as well.
What is SpaceX doing?
Well, SpaceX has three main products. One is our little rocket, the Falcon 1. Next, the big rocket, the Falcon 9, and a development off of that, the Falcon Heavy, which is a triple-core version of the Falcon 9 rocket. And then our Dragon, which is capable of carrying cargo or people. The latest contract we negotiated with the government was a development contract to build an abort system and start working on the design to adapt our cargo vehicle, the Dragon, to a crew transport version.
How many of them have actually been able to be launched and recovered?
Well, we have launched seven times. We've launched the Falcon 1 five times. The first three times we got closer and closer to orbit, learned something on each mission. On the fourth time, we reached orbit with the Falcon 1. Then on the fifth flight, we carried a paying customer's satellite. That satellite's up in orbit right now, taking pictures of the Earth. We took a lot of what we learned with the Falcon 1. We put that into the Falcon 9, which is a much bigger rocket capable of carrying a lot more payload into orbit. The Falcon 9 has flown twice. Last year, it reached orbit successfully both times. On its most recent flight, the flight back in December, it carried a test version of the Dragon, which circled the Earth 1.5 times, entered and splashed down off the coast of California. So we've got a lot going on, and we're looking forward to doing even more exciting things.
I want to talk further about this, but before we go any further, I can't help asking you, and I'd like to ask our next guest the same question. This, John Glenn, who was first to orbit the Earth, famously said that as he was sitting on the launch pad and the process began, all he could think about was that every piece of this, at that time, a complex piece of machinery was built by the lowest competitive bidder. What about the writing in what was just described by Mark Matthews as the most complex machine ever built by humankind?
Well, I enjoyed all my trips on the space shuttle. I thought it was a magnificent vehicle. But if you look at what happened during the development of the space shuttle, there was a choice that had to be made between maximizing the vehicle's capability to do useful work or maximizing its capability to be safe. When that decision was made, people looked and said, we think that we can take the escape system off of the vehicle. We think we've reached the level of maturity where we'll have adequate safety without an escape system, and we're going to put more of the emphasis on being able to carry cargo along with the crews. So I think that decision that was made was probably one of the most critical in that program's history. And it was that I probably would have thought more about while I was getting ready to launch than the fact that it was made by a commercial bidder for the government.
And was it after that the accidents occurred?
Well, I mean, those decisions happened very early in development. The belief was that they could build a system that was reliable enough that the risk of losing a vehicle and losing a crew was very, very low. The first four missions, there were ejection seats, and the crew wore pressure suits, and then the vehicle was declared operational for the next 20-some missions. The crew wore flight suits when they got aboard the vehicle until Challenger occurred. When the Challenger accident happened, there was a a reanalysis. They came up with a limited escape system, which is still on the vehicle today. Crews now wear pressure suits. They have parachutes. They're capable of jumping out of the vehicle in certain situations where it can't land. So they beefed up the emergency capability of the space shuttle. But, you know, we could have done that a lot earlier. We probably could have built a vehicle that had an escape pod in it. I think if the shuttle had some sort of an escape system that would protect the crew during ascent, that we would find that it would still be flying. That's what I believe. There's no facts to support that, but that's what I believe.
How do you feel about the Endeavour, which you flew on, flying its last mission?
Oh, it's bittersweet. You know, the Endeavour, I flew twice on it. It's a wonderful vehicle. And you know, each time I flew on the vehicle, I felt that the missions we were performing were worth the risk that we were taking. I mean, I really believe that, and I believe the mission that's occurring this next week is worth the risk that will be taken on that flight. I also believe that it's very exciting what we've got planned for the future. The new commercial vehicles that will come along, they're going to have enhanced escape capability for the crews. We'll be able to carry just as many people on the commercial vehicles as we carry on a space shuttle now. But those cargoes that the space shuttle can carry, those will go on separate vehicles. And ideally, the separate vehicle won't have to be built to the same level of safety as a crew vehicle. It doesn't have to have an emergency escape system that rescues the payload, for example. And the crews will meet their cargoes up on orbit, and they'll be able to do similar jobs that they do right now on the space shuttle. It'll just be safer. And I think there's a really exciting bunch of missions that can be conducted once we get that capability to go in and out of the atmosphere regularly, routinely, reliably. And economically. We can fly to the International Space Station where crews can do useful work. We can fly to the Hubble Space Telescope maybe to do repair work or whatever future telescope we decide to build. We can send people to a spaceship that we build outside of the Earth's atmosphere that can take us to the other planets that are in our solar system, or maybe even further someday. But the key is to be able to get in and out of the atmosphere safely, reliably, and economically.
Ken Bowersox.
That's what these new vehicles are going to do.
Again, Ken Bowersox is a veteran of 5 missions on the space shuttle, including the Endeavour, now Vice President of Astronaut Safety and Mission Assurance at SpaceX, a rocket company owned by the founder of Tesla Motors, Elon Musk. Another former astronaut is Mark Brown. He flew 2 shuttle missions, including one on the Columbia. He also helped design the International Space Station, and he was an astronaut representative on the Challenger accident investigation team. He's now Vice President of Aviation and Missile Defense Programs at MCR. That's a defense contractor. Mark Brown, good to have you on our program.
Oh, good afternoon. Thank you.
What's your feeling about this new vision, new phase of space travel and the emphasis on the privatization?
Well, the first thing to remember is this is really an exciting time. I mean, this is the first time in our history that we have the potential to make this transition, as Ken said, from a purely governmental program to one that has a commercial component. The unfortunate part of this is we're going to look at being down relative to our own access to space, the space station, for 7 to 10 years. So it's disconcerting that we find ourselves in this situation. But at the same time, it's a real opportunity for us as a country to figure out not only what we want our space program to look like, but to have this national debate on what we want to do with it once we put it together.
Before we get to that, how do you feel about the you mentioned being down for 7 to 10 years as
right.
far as our own access is concerned? Was there a better way to handle that?
Well, that's a great question, and probably a little bit above my pay grade. You could always say there were better ways to do it. We could have started follow-on programs much earlier, but we didn't have the financial ability to do that. And that's one of the big drivers behind all of these discussions is how do you afford the vision that you have? And that's why companies like SpaceX are so important as part of that discussion.
Let me just go back to Mark Matthews with the Orlando Sentinel briefly. It seems that there's been a kind of ambivalence on the part of Congress and the American people, for that matter, about the manned space program.
Well, I think a lot of it is generated by the fact that the next big logical step for the space program, in a lot of people's minds, particularly the American public, is a trip to Mars, that we've gone to the moon, and while a lot of people argue that there's a lot still to learn there, for folks who are, I guess, armchair observers of the space program, the next big trip is to Mars. And we're really starting to realize how difficult of a journey that is, that it's not just adding a few extra oxygen tanks to an Apollo-like craft and expecting to be in a spacecraft a little bit longer. It is a truly long and dangerous trip to Mars right now that, frankly, we don't have the technology in order to be able to do that.
Mark Brown, back to you. Again, with regard to the sort of history of ambivalence, everybody's happy about the space program when it works. When there are accidents, obviously, its popularity declines. But it's also apparently at the top of the list when people are asked, what could government save on? So does it make better sense, then, to get private companies to find the kind of incentives that they might have to undertake a mission like one to Mars? And what would the incentives be for private companies?
Well, that's a real complex question, and Ken's going to have to pick up part of this. But let me get started. The first thing is, this is a dangerous business, and there's no avoiding that. When we were in the midst of the shuttle program, we typically did studies ascertaining the safety and reliability of the vehicle, and those predictions showed that the vehicle should be about 98% safe on any particular flight that we would have. And that's a real good statistic. The downside is it predicts that on one out of about every 50 flights, you're going to have some kind of a catastrophic event. And that's pretty much what our experience turned out to be. Now, that being said, we have the opportunity, as Ken said, to go into a new generation of vehicles that give us access to space. Now, the way we do that is by improving the reliability of the vehicles, the boosters, all of the aspects of the spacecraft. And you get into a trade-off situation where you're trading off system redundancy for reliability. And just to explain that very briefly, on a shuttle program, for example, we have five basic computers that are used to control the craft. If you can improve the reliability, you may be able to get by with one, two, or three and save that cost, save that weight, save all that goes along with that. So a lot of what has captured our attention is SpaceX's drive to improve reliability to the point where you can reduce redundancy in the vehicles that then gives you more capability in terms of payloads and people and simplicity in terms of turning the vehicles around and flying them and with less cost.
So back to Ken Bowersox then, also a former astronaut now at SpaceX, the company that's done the most to get into outer space. What is the reason for going to Mars and why would there be a payoff?
Well, I would love to tell you that we're going to go to Mars and there's going to be something exciting we find there that changes the future of everybody on Earth. But what I know is really the fact is that humans are wired to explore, to move to new surroundings, and there is a constant pressure inside humanity to make that move. So I'm confident that it is going to happen someday. To try and pin down the exact date is pretty tough, but if you look back over human history and look at the way humans have moved from one part of our planet to another, I think you'll see that they made some very, very challenging migrations during those periods, and we'll see the same type of migration out through our solar system and then further away. It just is a matter of maturing the technology so that that can happen.
Well, thank you all very much for being with us again. Ken Bowersox is a veteran of five missions on the space shuttle, including the Endeavour. He's now with SpaceX. Mark Brown also flew two shuttle missions, including one on Columbia, helped design the International Space Station, and he's now Vice President of Aviation and Missile Defense Programs at MCR. Thanks also to Mark Matthews, Washington correspondent for the Orlando Sentinel, speaking to us from the Cape, where the Endeavour will be launched from tomorrow. Since she was shot in the head at a town meeting in Tucson, Democratic Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords is said to have made dramatic progress, enough that she's been able to travel to Florida, where she'll watch the launch of Endeavor, piloted by her husband, Mark Kelly. We'll have more on her recovery in a moment on To the Point.
For more information about To the Point or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/to the point.
Norman Olney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. Peter Boyer wrote an extensive story in last week's Newsweek magazine entitled What's Really Going On with Gabby Giffords. Peter Boyer, good to have you on our program.
Hello, Warren. How are you? I hope you can hear me okay.
I can hear you fine. You probably didn't write that headline, but let me put that question to you. What did you find out?
Well, you know, it's very interesting. I found, among other things, that there was a divergence between a lot of the coverage. There was and reality. There was this great sort of joyous moment when it was realized that Gabrielle Giffords had not been killed, and that in fact there was a chance that she would make some sort of recovery, and it became this sort of cascade, this media cascade of ever more cheery news that was derived from the tiniest tidbits of actual information. And I think the picture that emerged was not very realistic. She is, in fact, making progress that can be described as miraculous, but mostly because, in fact, her survival is itself miraculous.
So she has been able to travel to the Cape. It appears that she won't make any public appearances at all. What about the degree of recovery? There have been all these stories that she might go back to Congress and run again for her old seat in 2012, or that she might even challenge, or now that one of the senators in her state has stepped down, run for that office. Is that just wishful thinking?
Yes. Yes. I mean, I guess you and I both know that anything is possible. Anything is possible. But it does strike me as being wishful thinking, understandable wishful thinking. I mean, she became, oddly enough, the most potent political force in the state of Arizona, one of the most potent in all of Congress. With this shooting rampage and her survival and the story that emerged afterwards, to the degree that even people in her own party are sort of politely glancing at their watches and tapping their toes as they're waiting to hear what will happen. But her husband, Captain Mark Kelly, told me that he hasn't even talked to her about this. It's not the sort of thing that that she has spent, as far as we know, any time seriously thinking about, or certainly not discussing whether she would run for re-election or whether she would run for the Senate. Her staff and her political people, of course, think about nothing else. And I shouldn't say nothing else, but, you know, that's what they do for a living. So they are keeping the plates spinning while she recovers.
Didn't Mark Kelly tell you that she hasn't been told as yet that she was shot?
Well, she had not been told. He told her, in fact, a few weeks ago now, quite by accident. There was real concern about how much she could handle, how much she'd be able to process. And he made it his custom when they were both in Houston. She is here now, and of course so is he. He's fixing to take off atop that rocket. But he would go every morning to sit with her and visit with her before he went into training, and it was his custom to read the newspaper to her, and he was reading the paper to her one day, and he would censor himself whenever he got to a story about her and about those awful events. And one day, a few weeks ago, she sensed that he was doing that, and she grabbed for the paper, and he decided then to tell her that she had been shot, and he told her that others had been shot. She still does not know the details. She doesn't know about the little girl being killed. She doesn't know that her beloved staffer, young Gabe Zimmerman, was killed. She doesn't know that, and they're just not sure that she's ready to process that yet.
On the other hand, it is extraordinary, whatever her situation may be in detail or whatever the future might hold as far as politics is concerned, that she's able to go and see this launch tomorrow.
Oh, yeah, that is, it's, you know, there's a great deal of excitement here for a lot of reasons, but no small part of it has to do with the fact that Congresswoman Giffords is here. You know, I mean, it is. You and I are in the most cynical calling known to man. And, you know, the nature of the press coverage of this story, not just this week, but all along, sort of belies that. It is an uplifting and, in that regards, quite rare story.
Quite rare indeed. One of the reasons, as you said, no doubt, that the crowd tomorrow is going to be as large as expected, and probably one of the reasons that the president is going to attend. Peter Boer, it's always good to talk with you.
And you, Warren.
Special correspondent for Newsweek and the Daily Beast, joining us from Cape Canaveral. Today's program produced by Katie Cooper, Christian Bordahl, and Karen Radziner. Our technical director is Mike Newport. You can email us or share your thoughts on our comment page, kcrw.com/to the point, or you can join the conversation on our To the Point Facebook page. You can do both if you want to. I'm Orman Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International. It's just my job 5 days a week.
PRI, Public Radio International.
The British people are going through an age of austerity, but the royal wedding is costing taxpayers a king's ransom. I'm Armin Olney. On To the Point, monarchies may be out of date in modern democracies, but the worldwide audience could top 2 billion people. Why are Americans so interested more than two centuries after the revolution? Next time, on To the Point from Public Radio International.